The following content has been provided by New St. Andrews College in Moscow, Idaho. For more information, visit us online at www.nsa.edu.
So let's talk about common sense consequences, which is just another way of talking about how God made the world. God is not mocked. A man reaps what he sows. And as I've indicated before, we cannot make water run uphill just by saying Trinitarian or incarnational or communitarian over it enough times. Reality is not optional. The law of supply and demand is not a mere cultural artifact. In short, it is not comparable at all to the decision-making process that the lords of etiquette went through when deciding where the dessert fork should go relative to your plate. So the laws of etiquette can be revoked, abrogated, modified, changed, reversed, etc. The salad fork can be placed in another place entirely. The dessert fork can be put in another place entirely. But the law of gravity is a different kind of law. That's describing the way things are. The law of supply and demand is describing the way things are. So a moment's reflection should tell you that they could have decided pretty much anything about the dessert fork or dispensed with a dessert fork altogether. It's not hard to go from culture to culture and observe different customs, whether those customs are still fixed or in the process of changing. But the law of supply and demand is not a custom, even though it involves human behavior. So the dessert fork is picked up by humans conducting human behavior, and people go downtown and buy things at the market, also engaging in human behavior. And so people think, well, it's the same. We have authority over the one, we have the authority over the other. No, the law of supply and demand is a description of the way things are. It's not a description of the customs of mankind or the customs of this society or that one. So it involves human behavior, but it's not the same kind of thing as the behavior that is engaged in when we're exhibiting good manners. It is not possible to find a culture in which the law of supply and demand is not as fully operational and authoritative as the law of gravity is. So the fact that the functioning of the law of supply and demand involves human decision-making and choices does not mean that it has to be in the dessert fork category. If you have a stadium full of 100,000 human beings and there are 6 exits, a competent foot traffic engineer can tell you with a high degree of accuracy how that stadium will empty out. The nature of human nature will drive this, and it will not alter the law involved if we barricaded 2 of the exits. Right? People are going to behave in predictable ways. In the same way, Congress cannot, even if the American people demanded that the president be given a mandate to do so, Congress cannot repeal the law of supply and demand. They can barricade exits, and they can provoke stampedes, and they can get people trampled. That is comparatively easy, the kind of thing that governments do well. But to change the metaphor, throwing people off cliffs is not the same thing as repealing the law of gravity. In fact, it is, in fact, using the law of gravity to accomplish the evil that you're trying to accomplish. Market interventions don't do anything to the law involved. Market interventions don't do anything to the law involved any more than barricading exits does anything to what people decide to do under certain circumstances. They don't do anything to the law involved, but they do quite a bit to the people involved. And that is what this is always all about. You're not controlling the law of supply and demand. You're trying to control the people. Shall we go the way of coercion or not? If we go with the former, then we are not coercing the law, but rather using the results of the law to coerce people. And so we should be able to see that tax policies affect behavior. You barricade the exits, then the traffic flow is going to go another way. So you can intervene in the market, but you can't change the law itself. So there's a little internet parable making the rounds that a hat tip here to David Camerson, who came up with this. But I think I want to pass on this parable because I think it illustrates a lot of what we're dealing with. Suppose that, and this I'm talking here about tax policies. Suppose that every day 10 men go out for a beer and the bill for all 10 comes to $100. Okay, 10 men go out for a beer and the total bill is $100. If they paid their bill the way we pay our taxes, it would go something like this. The first four men, the poorest, would pay nothing. The fifth would pay $1. The sixth would pay $3. The seventh would pay $7. The eighth would pay $12. The ninth would pay $18. And the tenth man, the richest man, would pay $59. Okay? Goes from the four poorest paying nothing up to the richest, the tenth, paying $59. The 10 men drank in the bar every day, and they seemed quite happy with the arrangement, until one day the owner threw them a curve. "Since you are all such good customers," he said, "I'm going to reduce the cost of your daily beer by $20. Drinks for the 10 now cost just $80. Okay? The group still wanted to pay their bill the way we pay our taxes, so the first four men were unaffected. They would still drink for free. But what about the other six men, the paying customers? How could they divide the $20 windfall so that everyone would get his quote-unquote fair share? They realized that $20 divided by 6 is $3.33. But if they subtracted that from everybody's share, then the fifth man and the sixth man would each end up being paid to drink his beer." Funny. So the bar owner suggested that it would be fair to reduce each man's bill by roughly the same amount, so he proceeded to work out the amounts each should pay. And so the fifth man, like the first four, now paid nothing, 100% savings. The sixth now paid $2 instead of $3, 33% savings. The seventh now paid $5 instead of $7, 28% savings. The eighth now paid $9 instead of $12, 25% savings. The ninth now paid $14 instead of $18, 22% savings. And the tenth now paid $49 instead of $59, a 16% savings. Each of the six was better off than before, and the first four continued to drink for free. I trust you're still with me. But once outside the restaurant, the men began to compare their savings. "I only got a dollar out of the $20, declared the sixth man. He pointed at the tenth man, "but he got 10. "Yeah, that's right," exclaimed the fifth man. "I only saved a dollar, too. It's unfair that he got 10 times more than I." "That's true," shouted the seventh man. "Why should he get $10 back when I got only two? The wealthy get all the breaks." "Wait a minute," yelled the first four men in unison. "We didn't get anything at all. The system exploits the poor." The nine men surrounded the tenth and beat him up. The next night, the tenth man didn't show up for drinks, so the nine sat down and had beers without him. But when it came to pay the bill, they discovered something important. They didn't have enough money between all of them for even half the bill. Okay, and that, boys and girls, journalists and college professors, is how our tax system works. The people who pay the highest taxes get the most benefit from a tax reduction. Tax them too much, attack them for being wealthy, and they just may not show up anymore. In fact, they might start drinking overseas where the atmosphere is somewhat friendlier. And then you complain about why are they being unpatriotic? Why do they move to the Bahamas? When you start tinkering with the law, remember you're not dealing with the law. If I have a certain amount of money and the government takes it or takes part of it, they are not affecting the laws of mathematics. Let's say I have $10 and they take $8 and I have $2 left. They have not done anything to affect the laws of mathematics. What they have done is they've affected my life. They've affected me as a person. And that's what's happening with all this. Tax policies and regulations that try to steer or use the law of supply and demand. You're not affecting the law. You're affecting the people. So One book that I would want to recommend to folks is a very fine book on mercy ministry called When Helping Hurts. Oftentimes, poverty relief efforts are as well-intentioned as it gets, and they have been for a generation. But the results, unfortunately, do not match the intentions. We have to see the connection between the gospel and what it is to actually change the world. We must never forget which is the root and which is the fruit. But if there's never any fruit, then the root might as well stay buried, so to speak. There's good reason for believing that the promise of Deuteronomy 15:4 is echoed in Acts 4:34. All that said, we have to do things that actually help. We don't want people who live in grinding poverty living in our midst. We want the wealth of that God. If God is blessing a community, we want the blessing that's coming to the community to bless everyone involved. Disciples of Christ are called to heal the sick, but we should never confuse this gospel mandate with a less helpful mandate invented by our very own selves to treat advanced liver cancer with our specially grown juju beans, every one of them organic and dark brown. If you busted out your bottle and someone challenged you on it, it would not be enough to say that Jesus called you to minister to the sick, Luke 9:2. If you did, the reply that would come back would be something like, yes, but you're not. Okay? Doing something in the name of helping the sick is not the same thing as helping the sick. Doing something in the name of helping the poor doesn't count if you don't actually help the poor. We cannot just sling words like poverty around. What do we mean by them? Let's not be guilty of the dishonesty involved in equivocation. We have to remember Jay Richards wrote a book on God and money, and he makes a distinction which is very important between absolute and relative poverty. Absolute poverty kills. Many millions live in that kind of poverty. It is starvation poverty. So someone is living in absolute poverty if they're living in a cardboard box at a dump outside Manila somewhere, and they're going to die later this week because they don't have enough food or they don't have the right medicine. That's what we would call absolute poverty. Relative poverty is a different thing altogether, needing a different name. The Census Bureau, the American Census Bureau, ranks a certain number of Americans as officially poor, quote unquote poor. But a large percentage of these folks own their own homes, own one or two cars, own color television sets, and so on. These people are relatively poor compared to those on the other side of town who are relatively rich. But nobody in this scenario is going to starve to death. I bring this up because the discrepancy between my wealth and someone else's is none of my business, and it need not concern him either. I might be poor because I cannot yet afford to upgrade my iPhone, but things are tough all over, right? So if a husband and wife are having a conversation, so why don't you upgrade your iPhone? Well, we should wait a couple of months. We can't really afford it. Things are too tight. Well, they're making decisions to not get something because they don't have the money to get it. So that's a shortage of money. But for pity's sake, look at the world you're in. Discrepancies are not the issue, because there's a larger discrepancy between a millionaire and a billionaire, both of them doing just fine, than there is between me and someone at starvation level. The discrepancy is immaterial, right? The distance between a millionaire and a billionaire is much greater than if someone earns the average wage in the United States is something like $35,000, 35K. So the distance between that man and the person who earns a dollar a year is far less than the distance between a millionaire and a billionaire. But the millionaire and the billionaire are both going to go to bed with full stomachs, and they're going to sleep well, and everything's fine. Nobody's going to die. The discrepancy, the distance between different people is immaterial when we're talking about poverty. If I live in an economy where I have all I need to get by decently, and my purchasing power doubles every 10 years, but another stinking rich guy has his wealth quadruple every 2 years, the discrepancy between us is certainly growing, but not in any way that gives me cause for complaint. So when one of the things we'll hear in economic debates now, and the catchphrase now is income inequality. And I would submit that this is something we shouldn't care about at all. The case is quite different with absolute poverty. God has given us all great wealth here in the West, and we are called to be eager to share it with those who genuinely need it. But returning to the earlier point, such eagerness is not enough. We need to be generous in an intelligent way, wise as serpents, innocent as doves. That should be us. So going back to the income inequality issue, run this thought experiment in your mind. If you had an easy button in front of you or a magic wand that somebody gave you, and they said, if you push this easy button, then every poor person in the United States is going to have his standard of living get twice as fine as it is now. In other words, he'll be twice as wealthy in real terms if you push that button. So his car will be newer, his house will be nicer, his lawn will be greener. You know, so if you push that button, you have bettered the lifestyle of all the poor people in America, and you've bettered it by two, like you multiplied by two. But the price, if you look at me with squinty eyes and say, what's the catch? Well, the catch is that all the rich people in America will be 10 times better off. If you push the button, you make the poor people twice the amount better off, and you make all the rich people 10 times better off. Now, if you push the button, you have increased income inequality. The distance between them is increasing. But everybody who's poor has a better life next week. Now, if you would hesitate to push that button, then your envious heart is the problem. So it ought to be a matter of no concern at all to us that one man is rich and another man is poor, relatively. It ought to be a matter of concern to us if one man is starving because another man robbed him. If a man robbed another man and someone starves as a result or dies of a disease as a result, that is something the Bible calls injustice. But it's not injustice to be richer than someone else. It's not, you're not being oppressed if you're poorer than someone else.
New St. Andrews College thanks you for listening.